Good evening, everyone. Erev Tov. Welcome to the Sun and the Scriptures tonight as we continue our year-long journey in the Torah. And as we do so, again, we're doing it from that theme, the Sun and the Scriptures, looking at where that particular week's portion is either hinting at Messiah, foreshadowing Messiah, giving us greater in-depth information to understand Messiah or his ministry or his actions or his words. And so that kind of governs us and what we cover. Tonight will be, I think, interesting in that vein as we begin the book of Leviticus and begin to look at sacrifices in the sacrificial system, because this is where I find that many Christians and many in the church think this is hook, line, and sinker, but rarely have they actually ever looked at the sacrificial system. For instance, most people have the understanding that the sacrificial system was really about an animal being sacrificed in the place of a person so the person's sins could be forgiven and they not be killed. But what do you do with the fact that tell you 90% of the sacrifices had nothing to do with animals, shed blood, or sin? What do you do with the fact that a majority of the offerings had involved things like flour and grain and frankincense? So what do you do with that then? How is Messiah the fulfillment of that? And so the sacrifices are much bigger than what we often attach to them in the church, including the meaning of the word sacrifice. Again, when we hear the word sacrifice, we think again of just slitting an animal's throat and putting it on an altar. But Paul tells us that we are to use our bodies as a sacrifice. So clearly, Paul doesn't mean for us to do that to ourselves. So what is really the word for sacrifice in Hebrew? And what does it actually mean? And then we're in a better position to understand how Messiah is the fulfillment of those, or even how Messiah is a sacrifice, because two of the big sins in the Bible, in the Old Testament, if you will, that really get God's nostrils flaring and his face turning red, as the Hebrew would say, is the mistreatment of widows and the disenfranchised, and the other one is child sacrifice. And so, in fact, it's specifically forbidden to sacrifice a human or to sacrifice a child. So if you know that's prohibited in the Bible, what do you do with the father offering his son as a sacrifice in the New Testament? What kind of sacrifice is that? And perhaps you've misunderstood what kind of sacrifice the father was making with his son. And so sometimes this is where people think they know what it's about, and they have no idea what it's about. All right, and so we're going to begin that process. So let's get started with the blessing before the study of Torah. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam, asher kidshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu le'esok b'divrei Torah. Blessed are you, Lord God, King of the universe, who sanctified us with his commandments and has commanded us to be immersed into the words and the matters of Torah. Amen. All right, so this week, as I alluded to, we are beginning Sefer Vayicha, a brand new book, the third book of the Torah. We are beginning the book of Leviticus, the very first portion of that. It is the 24th division of the Torah's 54 divisions, and it covers Leviticus chapter 1 and goes through chapter 6, verse 7. Okay, chapter 1 through chapter 6, verse 7. Vayikra is the very first word of the book, and it means, and he cried out, or he called out. And we'll spend quite a bit of time looking at that very first word. In fact, a good majority of our time this evening will be on verse 1 and verse 2 of chapter 1. And this, again, looking at it through the lens of the Son and the Scriptures. And then we'll maybe delve into a couple of other places as we go. So what's happening in this opening portion of the book of Leviticus? Again, Leviticus is the central book in the Torah. There's five books: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. It's the central book. It's the pillar. And so everything actually flows around it. So much so that since We've known that there's been a scroll of it. Hebrew children, this is how they learn to read. This is their first book of the Bible they are taught. It is the book of Leviticus. So your Messiah, Jesus, as a child around 3 to 4 years old, was beginning to learn how to read, and he was learning how to read from this book. And this would have been the first book of the Bible that his parents or his teachers would have taught him, because it's about holiness. It's about holiness. It isn't just the manual for the priests and how to do sacrifices. It isn't just giving us details of the sacrificial system. It's actually teaching us a much deeper spiritual technology of what is holiness and how to be holy. Because that's one of the things Leviticus calls us to, is to be holy. What is that? So it is a very central book. So what's the Goodyear blimp of Leviticus 1? God calls Moses from the tent of meeting. He vayikras him and communicates to him the laws of what's known as the korbanot. That's the plural of the Hebrew word korban. You'd spell that K-O-R-B-A-N, korban. That is the Hebrew word for sacrifice. And as I was talking about, as we got started before the blessing, this is very fundamental to your understanding, not only of the book of Leviticus, but the work of Messiah himself when we speak to him as a sacrifice. Again, scripture is very clear. It is absolutely forbidden child sacrifice. Absolutely forbidden. Angers God. So then how do we talk about the language of the Father offering his Son as a sacrifice? It has to be understood differently, and that comes from this word korban. Because korban, yes, it can mean sacrifice, but it most accurately means in the Hebrew to be brought near, to be brought near. So it's even a passive. It's bringing someone near. That's korban. Therefore, sacrifice in Hebrew is not the slitting of an animal's throat and putting it on an altar, though that can be a form of a korban, a sacrifice. That's not what korban means. A korban is anything that brings one near to God. That's how Paul in Romans can talk about present your bodies as a living korban, a living sacrifice. Clearly, he doesn't mean to cut yourself. He doesn't mean to offer yourself on an altar. But when he says present your bodies as a living korban, he's saying live your life, speak your words, conduct your relationships in a way that draws you and others to God. That's a korban. And so Messiah is a korban, a sacrifice, not because of his death on a cross. That's something else. That is indeed meritorious for us. And it indeed is vicarious, and it is atonement. But it's not a sacrifice in the sense of because he's replacing an animal system. He is a sacrifice because it is through him and through his passion and his life and his teachings and his death and his resurrection and his ascension and his mediating at the right hand of the Father as our high priest, because of all of that, he draws us near to the Father. That is what makes him a sacrifice, a korban. He draws us to the Father. Okay, very important as we enter into Leviticus. And when God calls Moses into the tent of meeting and he lists to him the laws of the korbanot, the sacrifices, he talks about the animal and the meal offerings that'll be brought. And there's a list on your sheet. We'll briefly connect with them, mention them again, maybe highlight one or two, because again, we have to go past this. It's such a naive, simplistic understanding of the sacrifices that it actually is just wrong. It's too simplistic. The idea that the sacrifices were nothing more than putting an animal in the place of a human so that the animal died and the human lived, and that's how the human got forgiveness, was through this animal taking its place. Because most of the sacrifices, as I said, have nothing to do with animals, have nothing to do with blood, and have nothing to do with sin. And so when we talk about Messiah fulfilling or filling full, these sacrifices, these korban, these ways of being drawn near to God, it has to mean more than he's just replacing the animal, okay? And so we want to look at the sacrifices as spiritual technology. Then we can begin to ask ourselves, how can we even still do these sacrifices today? Because we can. The same technology that was embedded in them back then is still embedded in them even now. And so God communicates to Moses essentially five what we would call categories. We're Western, so we like to have categories and charts and lists and so forth. The first one is the olah offering in Hebrew, usually translated in English Bibles as the burnt offering, and we'll expand on that a little bit. That's not the best translation. I know why it's translated as burnt, because it's an offering that's burnt. But olah does not mean burnt. Olah means to ascend. It means to ascend. And so these were the sacrifices that were placed on top of the altar, and they were completely consumed on the altar by the fire. So they literally ascended, every bit of it. So other sacrifices, that's how the priests would eat. That's how they supported their families. So individuals would bring Thanksgiving offerings, and they would bring grain and wine and flour and meat and so forth. That didn't all go up on flames. That was distributed amongst the priests. That was an important function of these sacrifices. It was the paycheck for these priests in many ways. But the olah, the burnt or the ascending offering, is one that's completely consumed. So we'll talk about this one in relation to Messiah a little bit later on. But how does Messiah fulfill this? Clearly wasn't burned, right? But there is a way in which he offered everything. That's what the olah offering is that everything is used up. Same thing can still apply to us. How can we offer an olah offering even in this day, in the 21st century, 2,000 years after the resurrection of our Messiah, when we present ourselves and our works and our actions and our efforts completely and totally to our God so that every bit of it is used up? That is the technology of the olah offering. And that is what was in the mindset of the people when they brought this particular offering. Very important question to always ask yourself when you're in Leviticus. Don't ask yourself, what were they thinking? Ask yourself, what did they think they were thinking? In other words, what did they think they were doing? Not what do you think they were doing? What did they think was actually happening when they did this all those years ago, right? And then when we understand that, we are in a place where we can still apply it to our lives today. Second is God spoke to Moses about the meal or the grain offering, what's known as the mincha offering. And there's five varieties of that. These are offerings that are prepared with fine flour, olive oil, and frankincense. All right, so how is Messiah the fulfillment of that? This has nothing to do with sin, has nothing to do with atonement, has nothing to do with forgiveness, no blood, no substitution. We're talking flour, olive oil, and frankincense. How do these point to Messiah, and how does our Messiah's life, death, resurrection, ascension, and current reigning at the right hand of the Father find fulfillment in that? Okay. Then there's the shalamin offering, the peace offering. It was meant to be eaten by the one bringing the offering after certain parts were burned at the altar and other parts were given to the priests. Okay, so this was one where multiple people participated in a meal. And so in many ways, when we look at the Last Seder or the Last Supper of our Messiah, that has quite a few connections to a shalamin offering, a peace offering. And Jesus will also speak about that. Before you bring your gift to the altar, make peace with your brother and so forth. He's specifically referencing the shalamin offering. Before you bring this peace offering, and therefore take part of this communal meal, which when you partake of a communal meal, that's equating status, equality, that everybody's being honest with one another, that it's a true community. He's saying before you do that, make sure you're truly at peace. In other words, that's the real spiritual technology behind this. Then there were the chatat, which are the different types of sin offerings. Those are the ones most people are familiar with and erroneously often think is all the sacrificial system is, even though it's a teeny, teeny, tiny part of the sacrificial system. Most people think that's all it is. But that is the sin offering. Then there's the asham, the guilt offering, brought by one who's misappropriated property of the tabernacle, who is in doubt whether they've transgressed or not, or who has committed some kind of betrayal or defraud to someone in the community or to God. This was a way they could make peace with that. All right, so that's kind of what Moses is vayikrad. He's called out to, and God has this conversation with him. Okay, so let's dive into the text now that we kind of know what it's covering. Let's look at that very first verse, Leviticus chapter 1, verse 1. It says, then the Lord called, Vayikra, that's the name of the portion, and then the Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying. So at the end of the book of Exodus that we just completed, the dwelling presence, the Shekinah of God, descended upon the tabernacle and took up residence therein. Remember, that last part of Exodus was getting the tabernacle built and constructed and all of the furnishings with all the specific numbers of everything. And then essentially when Moses turned on that supercomputer, everything fired, everything worked. And because of that, the divine presence dwelt in with and among the people. The book of Leviticus picks up there and continues the story with God calling to Moses from within the tabernacle. The Hebrew name, again, of the book of Leviticus is Vayikra, from called. The Lord called to Moses. Leviticus 1, verse 1, is the third time that God has called to Moses in the Torah so far. Previously, he called to him in the midst of the burning bush at Sinai. And then he called to him from the midst of the cloud atop the Mount Sinai. And now he's calling to Moses from the tent of meeting, signifying that he has essentially left Sinai, that he's left the clouds, that he's left that place where the people were at the base and could not come up to him and was somewhat disconnected except through the mediator of Moses, that he's left that type of presence in reality, and he's now dwelling in the tabernacle itself. And God called to Moses from inside the tabernacle to give him instructions on how the Israelites should draw near to him. Catch that phrase? It's not about the sacrifices and then our head thinking slicing animals and blood and guts and all of that. He's rather describing how do people draw near to me. And so when you look at the work of Messiah, especially when you look in connection to passages in Leviticus, that's the question you want to make. That's the question you want to ask to find the connection of how did this draw people near to God? What was really happening? What did they think was happening? And therefore, how do we see that same spiritual technology being made available to us in our Messiah? Or, by the power of the Holy Spirit, by the work of the gospel within us, how can we still, through that same ultimate underlying technology, draw near to God, bring a korban, a sacrifice? So just as the voice of God called out to Moses from within the tabernacle, the voice of God, it still calls out to us from within the tabernacle, the living tabernacle made flesh in his Son, the living Messiah. And there Jesus calls to us and beckons us to draw near to his Father, to Korban, to the Father. In the Torah scroll, it's interesting, you know, in the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus makes that very famous statement, not one jot or tittle of the law will pass away. And so jot and tittle, usually explained as crossing the T and dotting the I, that's not an entirely accurate description of what a jot and tittle is. Rather, when you open up a Torah scroll, a real Torah scroll, a kosher Torah scroll, it's formatted in a very specific manner, and it's copied over and over, and if it doesn't look like the master, it's burned. There are no variations in the style of a Torah scroll. So whether it's 5 days old, 500 years old, or whether it's 1,000 or 2,000 years old, it looks identical. To the point where they know how many letters are on a line of every page, how many letters are on this column, what the letters begin each column. There's like a million different ways you verify a single page. But it's also the way it's formatted. Some pages will have three columns, some will have two, some will have one, some will have really wide spaces between words, some will have really big letters in a word, some will have little tiny letters in a word. All of that's intentional. All of that is called jots and tittles. And what's fascinating, it's in that graphic representation of the Torah on the page where so much gospel is contained in the Torah, that these jots and tittles tell the gospel. And so that's what Jesus is referencing. And so we have one of those in this week's portion. In fact, it's the very first word of the portion in Hebrew. In the Torah scroll, the letter Aleph at the end of Vayikra is smaller than the rest of the letters. So even if you cannot read Hebrew, you start at the right, you go to the left. So the letter on the far left, can you tell it's not the same size as the other letters? Yes, you can, right? You don't have to be able to read and know that says Vayikra, but that last little letter is a small letter Aleph, A-L-E-F, Aleph. It's the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, but it's always written small here. Now, it's going to come back up later because as the Old Testament concludes, there's a gigantic Aleph, right? And it's going to compare and contrast with this tiny one. But when you see this, you don't just go, oh, the scribe must have made a mistake and he tried to go back and write a little Aleph in there, or he was trying to be stylistic or something. No, every single Torah scroll that's ever existed that's considered kosher has Vayikra spelt just like that, right? So why, right? Why is that? And through the centuries, there are many, many, I cannot stress, many explanations of the diminished letter Aleph. The most well-known, the most common, the one that would be taught to a young child learning Hebrew, to learn how to read and speak Hebrew to a three-year-old, their explanation to, look, honey, look at the little small letter. This is what they would be taught by their parents. And it is the notion that here, as Moses is scribing out the Torah, he felt unworthy of being singled out by God, because it says, and God called out to Moses. And he felt unworthy of that honor as he spoke from within the tabernacle. And so in his humility, and in, I think it's in the book of Numbers, the book of Numbers actually says Moses was the most humble person that ever lived. So that's a biblical statement. And so part of his humility is he was embarrassed to have this honor. So this is in many ways kind of a quality you want in a leader, right? One of the things you don't want in a leader is someone seeking that position sometimes, right? You want someone who has humility towards that particular office, who maybe accepts the responsibility of it, does it faithfully, but at the same time never quite feels worthy of it. And certainly never wants to hold that kind of prestige or authority over others. And so when recording this incident for the Torah, Moses tried to spell Vayikra deficiently on purpose without the Aleph, which then would read, if you just took off that last little letter, that would form an actual Hebrew word. It would spell Vayikar, Vayikar is what it would spell. And Vayikar simply means, and he encountered. So Moses was trying to say, well, God wasn't really calling out to me. I mean, I'm I'm not that special that God would dare to call me into the tabernacle for one-on-one, almost face-to-face kind of conversation. No, I just had an encounter. He didn't, he didn't vayikra me, he vayikard me, right? And so he writes vayikar, so the legend goes, a less intimate word. And it's the word the Torah uses in Numbers 23, verse 16, when God met the Gentile prophet Balaam. And we'll eventually get there. But by doing this, Moses was suggesting that he was no more worthy or no better than he for hearing God's voice than Balaam, the pagan Gentile prophet. But God objected to this spelling of Vayikar and insisted Moses write the letter Aleph, thereby setting him apart from the likes of Balaam. Moses, of course, acquiesces, but only reluctantly, and so he includes the letter Aleph, but in humility, he writes it very small. So that's like the first lesson the little Aleph teaches people when they begin to read the jots and the tittles. So this is also what my rabbis began when I started studying Torah would tell me, look, you know how to read the black letters on the page. We're going to teach you how to read the white space. So when you read Torah, if you really want to read it the way the apostles, Jesus, first century Galilean Jewish people did, you read the white space also. And so part of that is knowing these kinds of things. So this is teaching about humility. Reb Moshe Chaim Ephraim of Sudlikov, the grandson of Rabbi Meir, once explained the small Aleph along very similar lines. He taught that after the divine presence filled the tabernacle, all Israel considered themselves worthy to hear from God, except for Moses. And because of his humility, Moses assumed that God would not call to him again. And that is precisely why God called out to Moses and no one else. Because it's the idea that others had reached this status of thinking, wow, we're the people of God, right? We have this great connection. And they were expecting these things from God now, except for Moses. And because he was humble and because of his humility, that is exactly why God did speak directly to him. And Reb Sudlikov goes on to explain the small Aleph when he says this, and quote, with the same measure that a man uses, it will be measured to him. It's one of your tools in your Hebraic toolbox, by the way. And just as Moses lowered himself through the attribute of humility, so too God lowered himself, so to speak, to go to Moses directly in the tabernacle. And here's where we begin to see a shadow of the gospel in the jot and the tittle and in the little Aleph. According to Sudlikov, the small Aleph alludes to God, not Moses, but to God, the master of the world, who lowered himself to the level of Moses, who lowered himself into Moses' world so that he could communicate directly with Moses. And he says, there is an allusion as well to the fact that every person should conduct themselves in the attribute of humility, and he should learn from the Creator himself, who humbled himself, lowered himself, to speak directly to Moses. And what is more, the lesson we learn from the small Aleph, that reminds us of Messiah, does it not? Who lowered himself to the level of humans. He humbled himself like Moses, yet was found worthy to be the vessel through which God spoke. So you have Philippians 2, verse 8. Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross, pointing to the incarnation. So this always reminds me of a very familiar story. It's usually taught or mentioned in devotions around Christmas time, but it's the story of a man who's sitting in his living room, and he has this great big window that overlooks the forest. And as he's sitting there, a bird comes and flies straight into the window, and it breaks its neck and dies. And so, you know, that was shocking to the man. And, you know, he goes and he takes care of the bird and buries it and so forth. And then no sooner does he get back to relaxing than he hears another thud. And another bird's done the same thing. And this happens like three or four more times during the day. And he thought to himself, if only there was some way I could become a bird so that I could communicate to the other birds to tell them there's a window here and to quit flying into it and killing themselves, right? That's the idea of the incarnation, that the infinite humbles himself to become finite in order to communicate with us, to vayikra with us, so that we might understand. And so that small olive has a nice hint to the incarnation as well as the humble nature of our Messiah. Messiah in the sacrifices. Next verse in Leviticus chapter 1, verse 2. It says, when any man of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of animals from the herd or the flock. So the book of Leviticus, Sefer Vayikra, begins with several chapters describing what we might call the sacrificial services. But now I want you to, when you hear that, think the korbanot or the korban, the technology for drawing near to God. That's what you have to reprogram your brain to say to itself when you see the word sacrifice in the Bible. When you see the word sacrifice in the Bible, you need to go, oh, here it's trying to describe a way that one can draw near to God. How is this action drawing one near to God? And therefore, how might I then understand the principle from that, draw a principle from that, a spiritual truth of what's really happening there, so that I can then do that and also be brought near to God? That's why this, if you really want to understand the connection of the sacrifices and Messiah, or why sacrifices, or reading about them, or studying them, even today when you think, aren't we in a different era and all that, why it's still very important that you know what they are, that you really know what they are. So God called to Moses, as we've talked about, from within the tent of meeting, from within the tabernacle, gave him these korbanot, this spiritual technology of drawing near to him. If any person desires to draw near to the Lord within the tabernacle, he's to come with one of these means of korban. And the Lord spoke to Moses, again, as we talked about in the summary, of five types, and that's the list that's kind of on your sheet. Again, the olah offering, I put burnt offering because that's how most English translations will do it. It's fine, it is an offering that is burnt, but you just need to know olah in Hebrew, which is what it's called in the Hebrew, does not mean burnt, okay? But there's the passages where the olah offering are described. Then there's the grain offering, which is called mincha in Hebrew, the peace offering, the shelamin, the chatat, the sin offering, and the asham, the guilt offerings. So those are the, for our purposes, you can nuance them, you could have a few more, you could combine them, but for our purposes in our Western mindset that like charts like this, those are the five main kind of categories of korban. It is well understood among believers that there are no sacrifices today, right? And that Messiah fills those sacrifices full. Absolutely true. Amen. Hallelujah. It's true, absolutely. However, people know to believe that, and that is a correct statement, but they often come to that conclusion for the wrong reason. And for me, that's not good enough. Like, it's like one time when I was in high school and I was on the math team, and somehow or another, I got worked my way up where I was the one representative in the final for our team, and it was showdown time. They popped a problem up on the board, and I had no idea what I was looking at. Like, I mean, not even a clue where to start. And so I put minus one as my, I just literally wrote minus one and quit. Everyone pins away, works, time comes. Five of us were competing, four were wrong. Minus one was the correct answer. We won the trophy. I got the right answer. I mean, I did. But let's get real, all right? And so, is the right answer Messiah, Jesus, fulfills the sacrifices? Absolutely, yes, that is true. But I found most people are just writing minus one, okay? So I'm going to try to get behind this a little bit more and better appreciate why that's a true statement and how that's a true statement. So believers are often erroneous in assuming a direct cause relationship between, oh, we don't have sacrifices anymore because Jesus came. You probably heard that, and maybe you believe that, okay? But we're commonly, and you find that cause and effect, or cause and causality, right? If you've studied any advanced kind of science technique and so forth, you know that if A happens and B happens, it doesn't always mean A caused B, or that there's a direct causation between the two. It may mean that A happened and B happened, but there could be C, D, E, and F that's causing one or the other or both of those to happen, right? So sometimes there's a little bit of that going on here. We're commonly taught that there are not sacrifices today because Messiah has fulfilled those. But in actuality, these are two different things. Though in conventional thought, they may have merged, unfortunately, into one concept. In reality, the sacrifices continued to be in God's temple for 40 years after the death and the resurrection of Jesus. And you might want to read Acts 20 and 21, because there, well after the resurrection of Jesus, James, the brother of Jesus, the leader of the Jerusalem church, tells Paul to go into the temple and make a sacrifice. And not only that, he tells Paul, pay for these four other guys their sacrifice. In other words, for 40 years after the resurrection of Jesus, there continued to be sacrifices in the temple, and believers and followers of Jesus, including the apostle Paul, yes, Paul, continue to offer sacrifices at the temple. And that's recorded for you in your New Testament. Acts 20 and 21, if you don't believe me, check it out. And what's even more fascinating, what sacrifice was Paul supposed to go and make? Anybody know the story? Has to do with, took a Nazarite vow. And when you conclude the Nazarite vow, according to Leviticus, there are sacrifices for that. So James tells him to do that. Why don't you read Leviticus for the Nazarite sacrifices? Because one of those offerings is a sin offering. So your book of Acts has the beloved Paul, who many people would have us believe was throwing all of this stuff in the garbage, has the apostle Paul making a sin offering in the temple with the approval and at the behest of James. So, there were sacrifices after Jesus, including by believers. Jesus' sacrifice is wholly different. It's higher, it's greater, and remember, it's a korbanot, or korban. It's about what did he do that draws us near to the Father, transcending the earthly sacrifices that are spoken of here in Leviticus. Again, it is absolutely true that Jesus fulfills the prophetic foreshadowing of the sacrificial services. It's absolutely true. But that is not the reason there are no sacrifices today. The reason there are no sacrifices today is because there is no temple today. Sacrifices can only be made in the place that God chose, which originally was the tabernacle and then the temple. When the temple was destroyed, the sacrifices ceased. So the sacrifices on earth, they are shadows. They do point to the greater, higher, and holier sacrifice that our Messiah is. Although there is no temple today, there remains for the people of God both sacrifice and atonement, especially in, with, and through our Messiah. But in what respect does Messiah fulfill these sacrifices? We understand fairly well that his death was a sacrifice for sin. However, only one or two of the types of sacrifices listed in Leviticus are even remotely related to sin, whereas the vast majority, four-fifths or more, do not involve blood, do not involve animals, and do not involve sin. Consider the burnt offering, the bread offering, and the peace offering. These were not brought for sin. These were not brought for atonement. These were not brought for forgiveness. These were not brought for those kinds of purposes. So in what sense does Messiah fulfill them? Keep in mind that long before there was a temple, and long before there were the days of the tabernacle, long before God called to Moses from within the tent of meeting, long before the covenant at Sinai, long before the sacrifices of the patriarchs, and long before even Adam's sin, this reality was true. Revelation 13, verse 8, that the Messiah was the Lamb that was slain from before the creation of the world. The heavenly Adam. Again, looking at verse 2 of Leviticus 1. When any man of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offerings of animals from the herd or the flock. In the year 1812, a Hasidic teacher, Rabbi Schneer Zalman, presented a teaching on this verse, Leviticus 1, verse 2, in which pointed out several grammatical anomalies in this verse. In English, it's all been smoothed out for you. But this is a nightmare in Hebrew. It doesn't look like anything. It looks pretty simple and direct. In Hebrew, this thing is a nightmare to translate. It's all over the place. If you were taking a Hebrew class and you wrote a sentence like this, the way it's written, they would fail you. It's that bad. However, whenever you encounter a verse or a sentence or a structure like that in the Bible, it's intentional. It's not like Moses was writing along and kind of was sleepy one night or just forgot some grammatical rules or whatever and got sloppy for a little while. No, that's, again, in a Torah scroll, they don't have bold and they don't have italics and they didn't have highlighters and they didn't have hyperlinks and they didn't have pictures. And so the way they would draw your attention to something and say, hey, you need to pause here, get your shovel out and start digging, was to do some kind of anomaly, whether it's graphically with the little aleph or whether it's with just a sentence that's like, wow, that's really messed up. Or whether it's repeating something like six times in the span of 20 words and you're like, well, that's a little redundant, right? And you probably have encountered that. Oh, yeah, it was meant so that you would go, oh, it's a little redundant. Oh, and nothing's ever redundant in the Torah. I better go find out why, what's happening here. This, believe it or not, is one of those verses where you do that. And Reb Zalman kind of talks about this. He notes that the passage begins in the third person saying, when a man, but then immediately switches to the second person. When of you, you shall bring. So he shifts from third person to second person, right? So it's not consistent with who's kind of doing the action here. The Hebrew even word for man in this passage is not the traditional word for man, ish. Ish, I-S-H, is normally how you'd say a man. But it actually is the word Adam, Adam, as in Adam and Eve. I mean, would that not slow you down if your English Bible said, when Adam brings an offering to the Lord? Wouldn't you go, aren't we in like in Leviticus? Isn't like Adam Genesis and like, isn't he long dead? Like, how's Adam bringing an offering in the tabernacle? Right, there you go. Get your shovel and start digging. So we have that. And then it also switches from a singular you to like a plural you. We don't catch that in English because the singular you is you and the plural you is you. Unless you're from the South, it's y'all. So y'all is a good, to me, y'all is good grammar because it lets you know you all, plural, right? That's why sometimes I actually prefer the King James Bible, because the King James English, that kind of English, actually does have different ways of saying you in the singular and the plural, and catching some of these. So there's also an inversion of word order here. Hebrew doesn't have to be in a specific word order. Like in English, we're used to, it has to be the subject, then the verb, then the object, right? It has to be in that order. Hebrew can function, but it still has a preferred way. And this is not the preferred way, especially when you take into account all the other things going on. So one would expect the way, for instance, the NASB Bible translates it, when any man of you brings an offering to the Lord, but it literally reads, when Adam brings you an offering to the Lord. So from all of this, here's what I'm really trying to say. This is a more literal translation of the verse. Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when Adam brings from y'all an offering to the Lord, that's the more literal translation of the passage. Based upon these grammatical anomalies, Zalman suggested the Torah was hinting at something deeper than just the surface Peshat reading. And it's fascinating what he comes up with. Because again, this is, Reb Zalman was not a believer. But it's fascinating what he understands from this literal translation of the text. Employing this reading of the passage, he explains that the man drawing near with an offering on behalf of the people of Israel was indeed Adam, but not the first Adam, but the second Adam. Wow, that's some amazing language, because that's the language of the Apostle Paul, who literally calls Jesus the Messiah the second Adam. Just as through one Adam sin was brought into the world, so through a second Adam, grace, redemption, and salvation are brought into the world. And there's this many correlations between that first Adam and the second Adam. Dr. Martin Luther in the Catechism, in his larger Catechism, deeply goes into the whole idea of the new Adam, or the renewed Adam, same kind of idea that Adam was like a prototype of Messiah, the second Adam, the greater Adam. And so Reb Zalman, he sees this and is like, well, of course this can't be the first Adam, because that's like Genesis and hundreds of years ago from the time the tabernacle was established. This must mean the heavenly Adam, the Messiah. So that's our son in the scriptures moment in Leviticus 1, verse 2. So Zalman says it must be the heavenly Adam, the second Adam, the messianic Adam, in whose image the original Adam was made. Jewish mysticism often speaks of the heavenly Adam, basing the idea on Ezekiel's vision, in which he saw in Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 26, a figure with the appearance of Adam seated at the throne of God. So Ezekiel gets this vision of the heavenly temple, the way John does in Revelation. And when he describes what he saw, was he says, not I saw a man, not I saw an Ish, I saw Adam sitting by the throne of the Almighty. Paul tells us that Jesus is this second Adam. He explains in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 47, the first Adam is from the earth, the second Adam is from heaven. And this is consistent with Rob Zalman's reading of Leviticus 1, 2. Jesus is the one who brought the sacrifice, specifically his own precious soul. And he brought it to God for all Israel and for all people. The olah offering. So we'll just kind of hang out here in this offering section of Leviticus. But I want to, beginning in verse 2, it starts describing those five categories. And I want us to look at that first category briefly. I think we'll look at the Ola offering, then the grain offering, to kind of wet your whistle on how to go about this. But again, my task or my desire is never just to tell you things and you buy them and believe them and go on from here. I only want to give you the tools so that you do this yourself. This is the only way you're going to grow in your faith. It's the only way you're going to buy into it. It's the only way you're going to have the aha moments. So I'm just putting some training wheels on your bike and pushing you, you know, or I've taken the training wheels off and letting you hit the road and not telling you I've removed my hands. So we're going to look at the Ola offering a little bit and how we connect it to Messiah and how Messiah fulfilling these sacrifices, these korban, these drawing near actions is more than often is understood. So the sacrifices were normally brought as gifts to God. So what did they think they were thinking? What did they think was happening? They didn't feel compulsion. It was not a drudge for them. It was not a burden for them. They were bringing gifts to God. That's part of korban. When you're in love with someone, hopefully you desire, naturally desire, to give that person tokens of your affection. Whether they always appreciate it or realize that's what you're doing, it's another story. But usually when you love someone, there are different points where you're like, oh, they love Snickers. I'm going to get them a Snickers, right? Now, they may just grab the Snickers and scarf it down, right? They may not appreciate that you did that because you love them and you know little details about them and small little things that really make them happy, you know? They may not catch that, but nonetheless, there's that tendency. If you're truly in love with someone, truly in a relationship with them, it's natural for you to want to give tokens of affection. The korban function in that way, very much that way. It's also natural to want to give gifts to God. One way of doing this was by bringing korban to God, because that would draw you near to God. That's hopefully why you would buy your wife flowers, right? Hopefully you're not doing it just so she's nice to you or just so she's not angry with you or so that there's some kind of quid pro quo going on, but that you're giving that to her because you want to draw near to her, because you want that to draw you close to her. This is the kind of thought that they were having when they did these things. And ordinarily, these gifts were not brought under any compulsion, as I said, nor were they brought as payment for their sins. The vast majority had nothing to do with payment for sins, atonement, or any of that stuff. They were brought by people who are earnestly desiring to draw near to korban, to their Creator. They were a means of drawing near to God and expressing affection. Much the same way when you approach Holy Communion or you bring someone towards for baptism, right? You're hoping that they aren't doing that under compulsion or that they're trying to earn something from God, but that rather that's drawing them to God. It's a spiritual technology to bring them into the presence of God and to bring heaven down to earth and bring earth up to heaven, and they kiss in that action. That's what they were thinking. Very sacramental. According to the Torah, the burnt offering, the Ola offering, was not, N-O-T, was not brought for sin. It is not a sin offering. It is a voluntary offering. Nobody ever had to do this, ever. No one ever, ever, ever had to do this offering. Completely voluntary and completely disconnected from the idea of sin, atonement, forgiveness, and blood. In fact, in Hebrew, it's not called the burnt offering, as I've said. Ola means to go up, to rise up. For example, when someone is ascending the podium to read the Torah in a synagogue, they are said to be making aliyah. Or if a Jewish person living outside of the land of Israel then takes advantage of that and gets Israeli citizenship, moves to Israel, they are said to be making aliyah, that is going up to the podium to read or going up to the land. Aliyah is based on the same root as olah. So why is it called an olah offering, a going up offering, a rising up offering? For one thing, it is the only sacrifice that is completely consumed on the altar. The entire sacrifice is burned up. There are no meats reserved for the priesthood or for the person who brings the sacrifice. The whole offering goes up in the heat and the smoke and the flame and ascends, as the text says, as a smooth, soothing aroma into the nostrils of the Lord. Therefore, the korban, the sacrifice of an olah, really represented this. You want to know what they were thinking for this completely 100% voluntary sacrifice that had nothing to do with sin, forgiveness, atonement, or blood. What it was really doing, what they thought they were doing, was a total and reckless abandonment of self to God, that they were dying to self and rising to their God, that they were losing their life for the sake of gaining their life. In other words, it's as if what they were of themselves was completely wasted and gone up in smoke. That's what they thought they were doing. That's what they were doing. That was their consciousness, their kavinot. And that's a technology we can still very much tap into. To imagine the effect of the olah, do this if you dare. Anyone have a $100 bill in their wallet? I would say a $500 bill, but anyone got a Benjamin? Come up here and light it on fire and say, this is an olah to the Lord, because no one profits. It's not like God has a bank account and the smoke went up there and deposited into his account, right? It doesn't technically profit God. You certainly haven't made a profit. Instead, one Benjamin note is now ash on the floor, soon to be completely gone as the wind blows and it gets stomped on and vacuumed up and so forth. That's an olah offering. The olah symbolizes a complete, reckless, selfless giving to God, the self to God. Jesus does fulfill this offering, the olah. His life was lived in total abandonment to God, his Father. He spoke only as he was directed by his Father. He did only as he was directed by the Father. He says in Matthew 26, verse 39, not as I will, but as you will. And repeatedly throughout the Gospel of John, he talks about, I only say that which the Father has spoken to me. I only do that which the Father has given to me. He continually gave himself over in total submission to the Father, in total, reckless, selfless abandonment to his Heavenly Father. His life, it was a life under the absolute way of his Father. And Jesus is also, remember, part of the olah is this reckless abandonment to the self, but also ascends. Jesus is the one who ascends. He told Nicodemus in John 3, beginning in verse 13, no one has ascended, olah. There's the vocabulary. See, now you get these ears and you begin to realize, oh, holy cow, John 3, 13 is sacrificial language from the book of Leviticus chapter 1. No one has olad into heaven. No one has ascended into heaven, but he who has descended from heaven, the Son of Man. Even so, the Son of Man must olah, be lifted up, so that whoever believes in him will have eternal life, will korban, will draw near. You see how rich the sacrificial Levitical language is there in what Jesus is saying? And how deep, much deeper it is than just, he replaces the goat. Jesus ascended as a korban. He was lifted up. He was olad on a cross. And there on the cross, he gave fully of himself. The $100 bill burnt up. And he ascended from the depths, rising up from the grave, and he ascended to the highest of heavens, right before his disciples' wondering eyes, making his aliyah, his ola, to the very throne of the Father. He who descended, ascended. He was indeed a perfect, living ola. Leviticus chapter 2, verse 1. Let's talk about the grain offering a little bit. Again, just to wet your whistle, begin to see there's more going on in these offerings and what were they thinking. Now, when anyone presents a grain offering as an offering to the Lord, really, the offering's an offering? Go figure. Get your shovel. His offering, do you catch that? When anyone presents a grain offering as an offering to the Lord, his offering shall be a fine flour. I'm not going to go into it, but that's a good hyperlink. What's fine flour? What's it represent? What's that telling you about Messiah? And he shall pour oil on it. We've talked about oil last week. You were in church this past Sunday. It was part of our sermon. So what's oil? What were they thinking, right? These are the types of things they were thinking. Oh, fine flour. Oil. That's what you anoint. That's Mashiach. That's put frankincense on. Oh, hyperlink. Find out more about frankincense. Not all the gifts brought to God in the tabernacle and the temple, again, were animal sacrifices. This is another one. No animals involved. The Lord also received grain offerings. Grain offerings were made of fine flour mixed with oil and adorned with frankincense. And some were baked, some were fried, some were offered as unbaked flour. In some places, the bread of the grain offerings were anointed, messiahed with oil. The priests were careful not to allow the flour to leaven before baking. The grain offerings were always, therefore, unleavened. They were matzah. It's on your sheet. They were matzah. These offerings were always unleavened. Oh, might want to find out what leavening has to do with. Oh, the Apostle Paul gives you lots of clues on that, right? Leavening is associated with sin. Jesus talks about that to his disciples, with the leaven of the Pharisees. It's sin, it's ego, it's arrogance. It's that which will puff you up and therefore draw you away from God. And so these lacked that. That might be pointing us to the Son in the Scriptures. They offered a portion of each grain offering, as Leviticus 2, verse 2 says, as a memorial portion on the altar, an offering by fire of soothing aroma, pleasing aroma to the nostrils of the Lord. The remainder they would break and share among the priesthood. Became part of how the priest brought home dinner that day. Messiah is also the fulfillment of the grain offerings. Nothing to do with blood. Nothing to do with sin and all those kinds of things. He is the bread of life. He was born in a city called Beit Lechem, which means the house of bread. And while still in Bethlehem, men from the east brought frankincense. You see how all these images now come in? That even the fact that he's born in the house of bread and wise men from the east are bringing frankincense is bringing you back to Leviticus 2? The grain offerings were also anointed with oil. Messiah means the anointed one, the one anointed with oil. The grain offerings were prepared unleavened. Messiah lived a life free of sin and corruption. That is, he was unleavened. During his last Seder, Last Supper, he took unleavened matzah bread, broke it, shared it with his disciples, just as the bread offerings were broken and shared among the priesthood. When he took, so what Jesus was doing there, very priestly role. When he took the unleavened bread, he broke it and he gave it to his disciples. He said, do this in remembrance of me. The same word the Torah uses to describe the portion of the grain offering burnt on the altar. He said, take and eat. And then he gave the further explanation. This is my body given for you. Really look at the language Jesus uses when he says that. Look in Leviticus and you'll find he's using Levitical language. Making it personal. So this week brings us kind of living in the times. Always need to know where we're at on the calendar. So we're coming up very close to what's known as Purim. Now, I won't go into all of what Purim is, except to tell you this will be a great week for you to read the book of Esther. Not a long book. You can do it. Great book to read this week because it describes what Purim is. That's where Purim is. In fact, it's where it originates. Esther establishes Purim, gives it the name Purim. And that whole story about the man coming up, Haman, who was a descendant of Amalek. And that brings to mind Amalek has been the enemy of God's people essentially from the beginning. In the book of Exodus, when they left the promised land, it was the Amalekites, those of Amalek, that attacked the rear. And thorn in the flesh throughout the history of God's people. And time again, God says, destroy them completely. And time again, the king does not. Amalek, when you take the letters that spell it, equal the numerical value of the Hebrew word safek, which is doubt. And so what's really being described there is that the great enemy of God's people is doubt, uncertainty, faithlessness, lack of stick-it-to-itness. So that's a little bit of a summary. Might want to dive deeper into Purim, Amalek, Esther this week, but I want to tie making it personal with that, because not only is Purim this week, but Vayikra is always read when Purim comes around. And so Vayikra is connected to Purim and Amalek and the story of Esther. All right, so with that, no, that's some of the background of it, but I still think even if some of that's new to you and you need to have some fun homework this week, there's still good stuff here just on the surface. So with making it personal, as we always do, begin with a story, sometimes an old classic that we all know or have heard or a variation thereof, or one where you're halfway through, you already know where I'm going, but that's okay. It always ties in with the portion. So again, if it doesn't seem like you're like, how is that fitting with the portion? Just means get your shovel and start digging. I promise it directly connects. The story. After an overwhelming week at work, Daniel decided to go on a nature hike in order to recharge. Without letting anyone know of his plans, he heads off into the mountains. As he is enjoying the view and the peaceful quiet around him, he suddenly slips and he stumbles off the edge of a cliff. He plunges downwards, but somehow manages to grasp a hold of a branch jutting out from the cliff face. He clings to the branch for dear life, trying not to look down at the ravine below. As his life is flashing before his eyes, he is struck by a very disheartening thought. I am alone. I'm all alone. Nobody even knows I'm here. No one will even know to come look for me here. I have no way of escaping. I'm going to die. He begins to take stock of his life, thinking about the good times he's had and what he's managed to accomplish in his short existence. He thinks about his family and how much he is going to miss them, and then he realizes he won't miss them, but they will miss him. And just then, a rope soars past his head, hanging directly in front of him. After a moment of shock, he grabs the rope and holds on for dear life as someone on the other end begins to pull him up over the cliff edge. As Daniel reaches the top, he's still grasping and amazed at the fact that he just survived this experience. He immediately asked the man who saved him, "How did you know that I was hanging on the edge of the cliff and that I needed to be rescued?" The man stares back at him blankly and says, "I didn't. This morning I randomly decided to go practice throwing rope over cliff faces." Now, there are two reactions that Daniel can have to this series of events. He can recognize the miracle that just occurred, dare we say for our ladies among us, a Kairos moment, thanking God for sending him salvation when all hope seemed lost. That is, he can see the divine in an ordinary random event. Or he can laugh at the unlikely coincidence that this man happened to decide to practice rope throwing the exact same day and time he fell over a cliff face. Thankfully that he happened to just get lucky this time. This is the exact decision we face in every moment and every aspect of life. And this theme runs throughout the entire Purim story. And the portion Vayikra always falls around Purim. So let's kind of poke around Purim and Vayikra. So we've already explored, there's a striking anomaly in that very first word of this week's portion. The first word of the entire Sefer, the entire book, Vayikra, is written with that small little letter Aleph, right? That's on your page. Talked some of the meaning of that. Is there more to this small Aleph? Well, there is a powerful connection between Vayikra and our timeless battle against Amalek, the great enemy of God that's always pursuing us, always hunting us down, causing us self-doubt, doubt in authority, doubt in organization, doubt in our spouse, doubt in our friends, doubt in anything and everything. That is Amalek. That is Safek. Vayikra, as I said, is not only read around the time of Purim, but sometimes even the week that we read the portion, the extra portion known as Zakar, our annual remembrance of Amalek's attempt to destroy God's people. Zakar means to remember. And so around Purim, you read a special portion and an additional portion, kind of like at Christmas time or Easter, you obviously have extra portions you read because it's such a big event, you read extra stuff. And Haman in the book of Esther is a descendant of Amalek. And so God, one of the commandments, mitzvot, connections he gives to his people in the Torah is don't forget what happened with Amalek. And so once a year, the people are read it and remind themselves so that they don't forget Amalek. It's read with Purim, read with Vayikra. So what is the deeper connection between the small Aleph and Vayikra and our battle against Amalek? In order to address this, let's look a little bit at the nature of Amalek. Amalek attacked God's people in the wilderness on their way to Sinai when the people left Egypt. And one of the striking aspects about the attack was its timing. God had just performed the miracle of the plagues, the 10 plagues, as well as the splitting of the Red Sea, acts that actually had worldwide reverberations. This made the people of God, this made the Hebrews, from that world's perspective, that time, world famous. Everybody heard about it. Like, how could it not spread? So all the nations knew of the miracle of the plagues and the splitting of the sea and this slave caste overcoming and defeating Pharaoh, the world power. Of course, that got around. And so the nations began to hear the truth of the one true God, the God of Israel, the God of Jacob. Okay, so that's the timing of it. The people were viewed, the people, the Hebrews coming out, they viewed themselves at this moment as essentially invincible, as untouchable. Amalek then chose to attack the people at that time. undertaking what was practically a suicide battle with zero provocation. This may sound eerily familiar to something like October 7th, 2023, a group of people who knew they had zero chance of any kind of legitimate success, but did it anyways because one kill is better than no kill. And they were willing to give anything and everything, even for one kill. What was their motivation to undertake this mission? This question can be extended to the Purim story. Haman suddenly is promoted to second in command, and he makes it his mission to wipe out the Jewish people. As a descendant of Amalek himself, he's clearly continuing their legacy of trying to obliterate the people of God. Why is it that throughout history, people have made it their singular focus to wipe out God's people? Amalek rejects God's connection to this world or any connection between the spiritual and the physical. Essentially, Amalek, or the spirit of Amalek, denies God's control of this world and the ability for man to uplift himself to the level of the spiritual. Torah is the epitome of both of these principles, and it provides the guidelines for how to achieve spiritual elevation. It is based on the axiom of God's connection with this world, and it is the means for elevating ourselves and our physicality for a higher purpose. Amalek stands in direct opposition to all things spiritual, to all things godly, to all things holy. So whenever holiness arises in your life, whenever you grow deeper in your faith, whenever you grow deeper in your understanding of God's word, whenever that goes up on the radar as a passion for you, Amalek will soon be attacking your tail. Guaranteed. That's the principle. That's why we must always remember it. And so, here they are, the entire world now, after the Exodus. They now have ears ready to hear the way of life, the way of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so Amalek has no other option but to attack and try to stop that. Amalek's entire existence is predicated on having a lack of connection between God and this world. Therefore, a complete acceptance of that principle by all the nations of the world, that now nations were going to be listening and coming to the truth, would mean Amalek would no longer exist. So Amalek attacked the people in order to prevent the giving of the Torah, to stop the world from accepting this truth, and to replace it with lies. And although Amalek was sorely beaten and only had a few survivors, they were utterly destroyed, and they knew they were going to be utterly destroyed. But they still managed to slay a few Hebrew warriors, and they also showed God's people that they weren't invincible. And then, most importantly for Amalek, they cooled down the spiritual passionate excitement of the nations of the world and paralyzed them from accepting the Torah. Amalek really won. Physically, they lost. They were obliterated. But in a deeper way, they won. They won because they won the world's heart. The nations of the world walked away, turning down the opportunity to accept the true God and his true path. We can now understand the small aleph and the word vayikra from a different perspective, and why vayikra is always read when you follow the times. It's always read when Purim happens. That's the way the lectionary always works. When you look at the word Vayikra with its tiny aleph, at first you only see the word Vayikar. Vayikar is related to the word of an encounter, or really a happenstance, a kara. This word embodies the essence of Amalek, a godless reality devoid of spirituality and meaning, a world of Haman, Hamin Ha'etz, of doubt, where a gap exists between us and God. Only when you look closer, deepening your gaze, do you see the aleph and you see beyond the happenstance of Vayikar, happenstance, impersonal, someone just happening to throw a rope over on the time you're needing it, and Vayikra, intimacy, personal, deliberate. Aleph, the first and most spiritual of all the Hebrew letters. It represents oneness and the transcendent root of reality. God is Echad, one, and our goal is to see the spiritual oneness inherent within every event and every object, not only in our personal lives, but in the world. Amalek seeks to hide that truth from you. He seeks to hide that God is in everything that happens with you and around you. He seeks to cause you to doubt that, and he seeks you to believe that that was a coinkydink, or wasn't that lucky, wasn't I fortunate. That is Amalek on your tail, feeding you a lie. Only when we see past the surface, the vayikar, the happenstance, can we recognize the little Aleph and vayikra, hear God calling to us, and trace everything that happens in this world back to God, the spiritual source, where we will ultimately defeat Amalek and everything that the spirit of Amalek stands for. So this week, some action points for you. Compile a list of your life stories. What are some stories in your life like that rope event? And review them periodically in order to recognize and feel the presence of God in your life, especially in those coincidences. What are your kairos moments, in other words? Journal them, write them down, write what happens in a day, and then specifically look past vayikar, happenstance, to vayikra, God calling out to you. You have to look to see the Allah. Second, we often can be tempted to mock or make light or doubt Amalek, an inspiring moment. And if we don't do it, trust me, someone will be glad to do it for you, right? You tell them your story of amazed things and they quickly poo-poo it, right? It's Amalek at work. When we do this, we can prevent that moment from having its full impact. So for the next week, be in the times with Purim and Vayikra. Combat the spirit of Amalek. Work on taking the ideas you hear to heart and allow them to penetrate your soul, inspiring you to grow and live a life of faith, not doubt. All right, we will close there for this evening. Hopefully you got a good intro into Vayikra, Sefer Vayikra, the book of Leviticus. We'll be back here next week. Let's close with a blessing. Baruch atah Adonai noten haTorah. Blessed are you, Lord God, who's given to us the gift that is the Torah. Amen. Shalom, shalom.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for engaging this teaching. You know, we at Emmanuel have as one of our goals to make our teachings available online to anyone, everywhere, at any time, whether that's through a podcast or our YouTube channel or an MP3 download. It is our gift to you, and we want you to use it however you see fit. Also, if you feel motivated or desire to support future teachings, you can do so with the donate button at the bottom of our teaching page. That's found at immlutheran.org/teaching. Again, thank you for participating in our teachings here, and hope to see you or engage with you somehow, some way, somewhere. God bless.